Hello and welcome to Science World. Today we'll hear about a new microscope called the Foldscope that's made of paper and only costs a dollar. But despite its unconventional construction and inexpensive price, the Foldscope is pretty powerful and can magnify samples by 2,000 times. U.S. President Barack Obama announced this past Tuesday a new initiative that calls for the creation of the world's largest marine preserve. And just a few weeks ago, NOAA's Climate Prediction Center said that there's a good chance of the climate phenomenon known as El Niño developing sometime soon. El Niños have been blamed for droughts, floods, famine, and even wars. Today, we'll learn about El Niño and the impact it could have on global weather. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A $1 microscope made of paper just might help diagnose diseases in the developing world and could also open the microscopic world to curious young minds. Steve Barragona has more.
The Foldscope takes less than 10 minutes to put together from folded pieces of pre-cut paperboard. It's a simple design, but powerful. Its lens can magnify samples 2,000 times. The Foldscope's designers say it could be a big help in countries plagued by malaria, for instance. The World Health Organization estimates the disease killed more than 600,000 people in 2012.
But the problem there is there are many different strains, there are many different medications, and you could potentially make the problem even worse.
In a Stanford University video, Foldscope co-designer Manu Prakash says it's important to know what kind of malaria the patient has, or if she has malaria at all. Microscopes are the most common way to identify what is causing the patient's symptoms. But microscopes are often lacking or broken in many developing world labs.
It's pretty amazing, actually. The number of broken microscopes is overwhelming.
Speaking by Skype, Duke University bioengineer Robert Malkin says those that can't be fixed must be replaced. But that's a big problem.
We work in hundreds and maybe even thousands of hospitals around the world. None of our hospitals can afford to buy a microscope. They're far too expensive.
And that's where Foldscope comes in, Prakash says.
It was a hard challenge thinking of making the best possible instrument, but almost for free. And that was our starting line.
The user punches the body of the microscope out of pre-cut cardstock, folds it up, and solders in a cheap LED light. The most expensive part is the lens, a 56-cent ball of glass. Duke University's Robert Malkin says it's a step in the right direction.
But there are a lot of other considerations in a microscope to make it actually work on the ground.
In many developing countries, staff who know how to use a microscope can be harder to find than the microscopes themselves, notes London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine epidemiologist Aurélie Gendron.
A microscope without trained human resources is quite useless.
However, speaking to VOA by Skype, Gendron adds that the Foldscope could be a useful educational tool. She works to improve access to clean water and sanitation and says if people could see the microbes in water that make them sick,
that might also help people change their behaviors and their beliefs, actually, in terms of disease.
Putting microscopes in the hands of the masses is part of Prakash's mission. His group is launching the 10,000 Microscopes Project, which will distribute Foldscopes to volunteers around the world. They will field test the Foldscope and come up with their own ways to use it. People from 130 countries have signed up. Prakash hopes to deliver all the microscopes by the end of the summer. He acknowledges the training gap in developing world healthcare, but he hopes that making the tools available will be a step forward. And he looks forward to opening eyes and minds to the wonders of the microscopic world. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama announced plans this week for creating the world's largest marine preserve by expanding a remote region of the Pacific Ocean where drilling, fishing, and other commercial activities are prohibited. Science World's Doug Bernard has this report.
Mr. Obama announced the initiative this past Tuesday during a videotaped message that was shown during an international conference on the oceans. The president is seeking to protect waters between the island state of Hawaii and the U.S. territory of American Samoa from overfishing and environmental damage.
Pollution endangers marine life. Overfishing threatens whole species as well as the people who depend on them for food and their livelihoods. If we ignore these problems, if we drain our oceans of their resources, we won't just be squandering one of humanity's greatest treasures. We'll be cutting off one of the world's major sources of food and economic growth, including for the United States, and we cannot afford to let that happen.
Officials say the exact boundaries of the preserve have not yet been set, but that Mr. Obama could expand the protected area already in place from 225,000 square kilometers to more than 2 million. The protected ocean area was first designated a U.S. Marine Monument by his predecessor, President George W. Bush. Mr. Obama also plans to create a government program to combat black market fishing and seafood fraud, where seafood products are mislabeled to hide where they were harvested. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll learn about the possible development of an El Niño, a climate phenomenon that can impact weather systems throughout the world. So, with El Niño in mind, it's time for the Science World Quick Quiz. An El Niño usually develops when ocean waters in the equatorial Pacific warm up. But there's also another related climate event that can develop when those waters cool down. What is that relative of El Niño called? Is it A, El Anciano, B, La Niña, or C, La Anciana? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now. Listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine. Researchers have discovered that mutations to a particular gene can dramatically lower the risks for a heart attack. So scientists are now trying to develop drugs that target the gene in hopes of bringing down the high rate of heart disease. Jessica Berman reports.
Two papers published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine identify a gene called APOC3 in connection with the body's removal of triglycerides, a type of blood fat. Circulating triglycerides, if not eliminated from the body, stick to blood vessels and are stored in tissues in the hips and belly. When elevated, triglycerides or lipids are thought to be a risk factor for heart disease. Approximately 1 in 150 people has mutations to the APOC3 gene that keep their triglyceride levels low, according to the findings of a new study. Sekar Katharasan is director of preventive cardiology at Massachusetts General Hospital and an associate researcher at the Broad Institute of Medical Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Katharasan helped lead the study that identified four beneficial genetic mutations to the APOC3 protein. A large investigation of 110,000 patient blood samples found those with the rare mutations had lower levels of triglyceride fats and a significantly reduced risk for the most common form of heart disease.
We compared the heart attack rates in the people who carried the mutation and those who didn't, and found that the people who carried the mutation and had the lower triglycerides had 40% lower risk for heart attack.
The connection with elevated LDL, a blood fat commonly called bad cholesterol, and heart disease is well known. Experts know less about the benefits of raising HDL, or a blood lipid called good cholesterol, as a hedge against heart attack, and the role triglycerides levels play in coronary artery disease. The latest study of thousands of research subjects found elevated levels of good cholesterol were not protective, while low triglyceride levels appear to be. With discovery of the four mutations, Katharasan says researchers now have a target to develop a drug to lower blood lipids, reducing the risk of heart attack.
Given that these people are naturally protected, if you develop a medicine that mimics this, then you know your chances of it working in terms of reducing risk of heart attack are quite great.
Katharasan says many people still have elevated triglycerides despite exercising, eating a low-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, and taking statin drugs. He says an agent that targets APOC3 may further reduce blood fats, lowering the risk of heart attack. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
One of the most widespread conspiracy theories of recent years has concerned a radio frequency facility in a remote part of Alaska, started by the military in 1993 and known by its acronym, HARP. Critics allege the government was trying to control the weather and even people's minds. But George Putich tells us that scientists who work there say that the fears are unfounded and that they are now fighting to preserve the project from being shut down.
The late inventor Nikola Tesla, whose ideas and designs contributed to our modern electricity supply system, claimed it is possible to send power through the air. Dennis Papadopoulos, a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Maryland, says Tesla was a genius.
He had a lot of wonderful ideas. About 10% were great, and the 90% ended up being crackpotish.
Sure, we can send some power through the air. That is how we listen to the radio, watch TV, and talk through mobile phones. But radio waves deteriorate with distance, and even more so when they pass through water. That is one of the reasons the U.S. military began the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP. The 12-hectare facility has rows of towering antennas, 180 in all, each with a transmitter. Together, they can send up to 3.6 million watts into the ionosphere, the electrically conductive part of the upper atmosphere that can bounce radio signals back to Earth. Papadopoulos, who was involved in the research at the Alaska facility, says one of the military's major interests at the time the project was conceived was communication with submarines on patrol.
To communicate with submarines, you have to have very low frequencies, which means wavelengths which are 1,000 kilometers or larger. To create those with ground stations, you have to have installations that were half the state of Wisconsin.
He says the idea was to turn the ionosphere into a giant antenna to transmit signals underwater. The United States was also concerned with the possibility of a nuclear bomb blast in the atmosphere, increasing the density of electrons in the radiation belt and disabling all its satellites. Papadopoulos says so little was known about the ionosphere that each new experiment led to new discoveries.
We discovered for the first time that we could create our own little ionosphere. Namely, we can increase the density of the electrons and create patches which we could use as reflectors of any frequency we want. So we can really guide even gigahertz waves around.
But controlling the weather or causing earthquakes? The idea that an individual project could have an effect greater than the polar vortex, the energy of the sun, or even the total sum of human interactions with nature is rather difficult to believe, says George Washington University Space Policy Institute Director Scott Pace.
Yes, there's lots of conspiracy theories because I think people like to believe that somewhere, someone, some human is in control. The actual answer is things are actually much more chaotic and much more not subject to our control. Mother Nature doesn't care. Therefore, trying to understand what is going on with nature is much broader and bigger than any individual project.
Scientific advances and shrinking budgets caused the U.S. military to propose closing the facility this year. Papadopoulos says the international scientific community would like to keep HARP open, and offers to contribute to its $5 million annual budget have come from Canada, Britain, and Taiwan. Congress is expected to decide soon whether to accept that help. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the right answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. A weather event called El Niño usually develops when ocean waters in the equatorial Pacific warms up. But there's also a related climate event that can develop when those waters cool down. What is that relative of El Niño called? Is it A, El Anciano, B, La Niña, or C, La Anciana? The answer is B. La Niña, which means the little girl in Spanish, is the sibling climatic event to El Niño, which of course means the little boy in Spanish. La Niña has the opposite impact of El Niño. Where an El Niño might bring rainy weather to a particular region and cause possible flooding, a La Niña, on the other hand, could cause unusually dry and maybe even drought conditions in that area. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
This past March, officials at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center saw signs that there is a really good chance of the cyclical weather phenomenon called the El Niño Southern Oscillation, commonly referred to as just El Niño, developing in the coming months. The possible return of El Niño has a lot of people from around the world quite anxious, since many remember the global impact of previous El Niños. And there's good cause for the concern. An El Niño, which develops as the result of warming ocean waters in the equatorial Pacific, has, in the past, impacted the weather systems of locations throughout the world. Some of these changes in normal weather patterns can prove to be devastating to local economies, especially those in developing nations. Mike Helpert, the acting director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, which keeps an eye out on El Niño and its sister La Niña, joins us today to explain these climatic phenomena, the impact they have on the world's weather, and what we might expect within months or even a year from now as a result of a possible El Niño. What is El Niño?
All right, El Niño typically refers to a warming of the equatorial Pacific Ocean, so an area from about the dateline eastward to the South American coast. Sea surface temperatures become warmer than average, and when that happens in a fairly pronounced fashion, it then interacts with the atmosphere and results in changes in tropical rainfall, which then have links really globally.
What about El Niño's sister, La Niña? What's the difference between it and El Niño?
It's actually quite simple. El Niño is when the ocean becomes warmer than average. La Niña, the ocean becomes colder than average. It is really part of one cycle, something that we refer to as ENSO, or the El Niño Southern Oscillation, with the El Niño part of that referring to changes in the ocean and the Southern Oscillation referring to changes in the atmosphere.
What factors come together to develop an El Niño or La Niña?
Factors, if we're just kind of focusing on the ocean itself, and it's kind of an interesting phenomena in that sometimes it seems like the ocean leads the atmosphere, but there are times when it's actually the atmosphere that's driving the ocean. A good example of that would be really how this developing El Niño really got kick-started back in February and March. We saw what we refer to as a westerly wind burst in the western part of the basin. That's it's actually a reversal in the low-level wind, so that instead of blowing from east to west, they blow from west to east. And that initiates that change in the stress on the ocean surface, kicks off what's called an oceanic Kelvin wave. Just kind of think of a big wave that's moving not at the surface of the ocean, but below the ocean. And that really was kind of the mechanism that kicked off and pushed all the warm water from the western Pacific into the central and eastern part of the basin below the surface. And once it's below the surface, then it just usually takes a relaxation of the winds for it to get to the surface. And that's when we would have El Niño. And right now, looking at the Pacific, the ocean is modestly warmer than average. It's the areas that are the most above normal or in the far eastern part of the basin and around the dateline. We don't yet have what we would term an El Nino yet, because despite the warming of the ocean, we're not really seeing those changes in tropical rainfall and in the low-level winds, and also we really haven't seen a consistent reflection in the atmosphere yet.
When we hear about El Nino or La Nina, we think about the way it impacts different parts of the world. How does these weather phenomena affect parts of the world?
Well, throughout the tropics, the most direct area that sees a relationship with El Nino is kind of the Pacific Basin, maybe extending over from, say, the Indonesia, Northern Australia area. And that's really makes the most sense. As you warm the waters in the central and eastern part of the basin, the typical rainfall pattern that we see, which favors the rainfall over Indonesia and the Western Pacific, follows the warmest water and shifts out of that area. So in a well-developed El Nino, those areas become drier than average, and the central and eastern part of the basin, although most of that is just over ocean, becomes wetter than average. But it's those shifts in tropical rainfall and shifts in the pattern of heating into the atmosphere that have impacts on the jet stream across the Pacific and in both the southern and the northern hemisphere. So typically El Nino will favor wetter than average conditions in the West Coast, mainly in southern and central California, although actually the better signal over North America is in the Gulf Coast, really, from like Texas to Florida. That's a very reliable signal, but these are signals that are related to the change in the position of the jet stream across the Pacific Ocean. Likewise, in the southern hemisphere, we see wetter and drier than average areas, again, related to this change in tropical heating.
And finally, Mike, have there been any really memorable El Niños, La Niñas that really impacted weather?
Well, sure. And this is kind of some of the, I think, heightened interest in El Nino this year, is that the last really strong event we had was back in 1997, that lasted into the earlier part of 1998. That was, at least as determined by the magnitude of the ocean temperature departures, the strongest in that we've documented in modern times. And the impacts were very strong and really were felt all around the world. From too much rain in California, so flooding and landslides, to drought in Indonesia and southern Africa. These are you know, very well-defined, and those are kind of like the classic El Nino. You know, folks back a few months ago, as this event started to evolve, there were some similarities to what happened in March of 97. And so folks kind of jumped on saying, oh, here comes another 97, 98 event. But from my own perspective here at the Climate Prediction Center, we were much more cautious than that, because we're not in favor of looking at an analog of one and saying, well, this is the same, so everything that follows will be the same. There's really a lot of natural variability in our climate system, and so it's hard to make a leap comparing, you know, 1 month to a year at some time in the past and say, well, this is everything that's going to happen over the next year. And at this point, this event seems to be one that's not going to even approach 97, 98, not even close. At this point, we're really favoring a more moderate type of an event.
That was Mike Helpert, Acting Director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the Internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.